So today we're continuing our study through Hebrews, and we're going to be in Hebrews 8, and I hope you have been able to read ahead, and if you haven't, well, we'll read through it today. This is so jam-packed of stuff. I tried to jam everything in this sermon. Well, not everything. Otherwise, we'd be here way too long, probably. But I do have a fair amount here I wanted to concentrate on. And the main theme, well, you'll see here. First, I wanted to show you this picture, all right? Anyone know who this is? Peter Pan, yeah. Peter Pan and Wendy. And I like this picture because, well, I don't know if you can notice the what's going on here. If you notice the shadow, right, it's disconnected from Peter there. And I don't know if you can see what Wendy's doing, but she has a needle and some thread, and she has the shadow in her hand, and she's attempting to sew the shadow back onto Peter. Today in Hebrews 8, it has one of my favorite themes for understanding how God works in the world, in his actions, and understanding him, and also our relationship with God and how we view that in some different dynamics with that. And that has to do with shadows. Shadows and reality, or you can say shadow and light. I'll refer to the light as reality this morning. And we'll come back to this picture, and I'll explain what I mean by putting this picture up here. And if you were here last week, we were going through Hebrews 7. Keegan talked about Melchizedek and how Jesus is our high priest in the order of Melchizedek, and what that means for us and for Jesus. And this morning it goes right into, it's still talking about Jesus as our high priest in Hebrews 8 right here. And I'm just going to read this. Now the point is what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve, note here, they serve as a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, the tabernacle, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." Here the author of Hebrews is saying, this is the reality that the author is trying to reveal to us is that Jesus is our high priest, that Jesus is seated on the throne that rules the world, and that the old system that Israel was under, the old priestly system, where the priests were making sacrifices, all those things are but shadows of the reality, the true reality of Jesus being our priest forever, who loves us and is currently interceding for us. And I want to make sure you guys understand, this is the present reality, not just back when Hebrews was written, not, you know, just some time ago. This is right now. And we see in verse 5 this reference to the copy and shadow of the heavenly things. And so what is the shadow? The shadow is the earthly priests, the systems of interacting with God that Israel did through the law, and all that is interacted with God in that, in the old covenant system. And so we have to go back to this picture again. I want to explain this a little more. Because Wendy here, she's putting the shadow back on Peter Pan, okay? She's sewing it back on. And by attaching, in essence, what she's doing to Peter Pan there, by attaching his shadow back to him, is kind of like what we do when we read the Old Testament. When we look at the Old Testament scriptures, we're looking at the Old Covenant, and we're looking to see how they're connected to God, how they reveal Jesus, the true reality, the trueness, you could say, of that shadow, what it's revealing. And so the law, the priestly system, the prophets of old, all are shadows pointing us to the true reality, and that is Jesus. And I would actually say, in a sense, the entire Bible is that. It's pointing us to Jesus, right? We don't worship the Bible. We worship the God of the Bible, and that is Jesus. You know, sometimes we can read the Old Testament, maybe, or we can read another passage of Scripture, and if we're not viewing it through the reality, through the true reality of Jesus, what do we end up with? We end up by focusing on the shadow, and it becomes moralistic. It becomes just a shadow. It's a dark image. It's disconnected from God. We have to keep this connected to Jesus, wherever you're reading in the scriptures. And the author of Hebrews is saying, don't focus so much on the old law, because he's speaking to Jews who were used to the old system. Saying, don't focus so much on that old law, the old system, because it was all meant to lead you to the present reality of who Jesus is. Jesus is now our law. He is now our system, if you want to call it that, our religious system, if you want to say it that way. But as it is, so this is the reality that Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for the second. Current reality is that Jesus is our mediator. He's our priest. He's our, you could say, lawyer, our advocate, our representative of a better covenant than the old one. And in this context, he's talking about covenant as equal to their law. He's and kind of their system of rule and how they were to operate. And it says here, it does say that the first covenant had, if that first covenant had been faultless, we'll see in the next verse that the fault is not actually in the law itself or the old covenant itself. The fault is actually in the people. Verse 8, for he finds fault with them when he says, behold, the days are coming. This is, just so you know, this is a prophecy from Jeremiah 31 that is quoted here. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, the people of God, okay? A new covenant. Not like the old covenant, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on that day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, for they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. This is a prophecy, like I said, given in Jeremiah 31, where the people of God were given a preview of what was to come and what was to be enacted in due time. And it appeals to their history, right? They were slaves in Egypt, and God brought them out of the land of Egypt, that kind of thing. But they broke that covenant. And part of them breaking that covenant, God, he always keeps his covenant. And part of the covenant were covenant curses that Israel brought on themselves because they did not obey the old covenant. And so that's why it says God showed no concern for them. He left them to their own devices, the sin in their lives. But wait, I like saying that. Oh, wait, it's not done. There's more. A new covenant. And this is awesome because this is where we are in. We are living in this new covenant. If you are submitting to Jesus, this is your this is the covenant contract, if you want to say it that way. Let me read it. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law into their minds and write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people, and they shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful toward their iniquities, toward their sins, and I will remember their sins no more. This is awesome. This is us. This is what we get to participate in. And what are some of the elements of this covenant, this new covenant? Where is the law? Tell me, where's the law? Come on, interaction. Where's the law? Our hearts? Yeah. It's on our minds. It's written on our heart. The true God will be their God. The true people of God will be his possession. They don't have to teach each other to know God. I mean, this one's a hard one. I'll talk about this a little bit later. I still don't get this completely, but it excites me, I guess. Everyone will know him. Everyone will know him. If you're a part of this covenant, you know God, and it doesn't matter how dumb you think you are, and it doesn't matter how smart you think you are. It doesn't matter your IQ. It doesn't matter your age. If you're part of this covenant, you know God. God will be merciful to their iniquities or their sins. Praise God. And God will forget their sins. This one is hard for me to wrap my mind around. I just believe it, all right? I don't know how God forgets things, but apparently he forgets our sin. I just want to look at one little aspect right now, though, of this. Actually, I want to look at a shadow, okay, of before, just to help us get an idea of the significance of this covenant. And I'm not going to focus, like, totally on the covenant. Covenant is, you can study covenant for years, and there is so much in covenant language, you could say. But I just want to test you guys maybe just a little bit. I don't know if you've ever thought about where the old law was put in the Old Testament. When Israel was in the wilderness and when they were at Mount Sinai, they received the law of God, and it was represented as these two stone tablets, the Ten Commandments, and it was written on there, and that was typical of covenants in that time, that it would be written on stone tablets, so you don't change it, and they would be presented at certain places. But where were the Ten Commandments stored? Does anyone remember? Ark of the Covenant. Yes. It was placed in the Ark of the Covenant, which is where God himself would come, and he would dwell with Israel. He was in the cloud or the fire or whatever. It was this huge, awesome thing. And he would come and dwell there. Did you ever think about that? I honestly didn't think about this until I was studying this. Today, God continues. He continues to dwell where his law is placed. The Holy Spirit comes and he dwells in you. He's on your mind and he's in your heart. The law is written in our hearts. The law, what God wants us to do, is written there. His desire for us enters into our minds and it's written here in our hearts. We accomplish what he wants through our lives, and we are living covenant arcs. And as we accomplish what he wants in life, as we accomplish what he wants, his will, the law that he places on us, we're actively worshiping God through that. And just think about that. We're a whole bunch of living covenant arcs of the covenant, gathered together here, and we make up his temple. That is a beautiful picture. Do you understand the significance of this? I think sometimes we take this for granted. Keegan last week talked about taking things for granted, like the fact that we can even talk to God. In our gatherings, we can know God, and we can see God by sharing together about the experiences of our lives. and how God is making himself known to each one of us. I was thinking this thing of like to know God, right? And how do you know God? I was thinking, I have children, of course, so I think about this. But hang out with God's children. Because if you hang out with children, they help you, they have a way of letting you know what their parents are like. And since I'm a parent of my children, you know, sometimes we push our children, we have our grandparents maybe watching them. I didn't tell them I was going to talk about this, but last Friday and Saturday, Corliss and I were away. We were able to just get away for a night. We went up to Watkins Glen. It was our 12th anniversary celebration, which is awesome. I can't believe it. God has brought us a long way. But anyways, we were up there by ourselves, and the children were with their grandparents. And it's always fun to like ask them, hey, did you do anything exciting? And you know, they just reveal what life is like for grandpa and grandma. It's not the big things, it's the little things. Like last time they just revealed that they had Lucky Charms for breakfast. Which we don't have in our house, but you know, it's special. They get to enjoy that, and it's awesome. It's so much fun. It's the little things that stick out. Or I have to pick on Jay a little bit. Grandpa, he drinks his chocolate milk. He does this. They have it down to a T. I don't know how they do it. Something like that. I think it's the chocolate milk, right? Or when he eats, his head goes like this. Some of you understand that. It's those little things. If you want to know what God is like, hang out with his children. Hang out with his children. Now, I just shared, you know, a couple different aspects there of knowing God and ways in which we can know God, but and mainly through our experiencing together, our sharing together. And I think that's so important. And even in preaching, I'm up here preaching, I'm sharing about God. And hopefully I can inspire you in some way to open yourself up to God. But really I'm not doing a whole lot more than explaining to you about God, okay? And there's a little more. I think the Spirit works through that. But to truly know God is to actually, it happens on an experiential level. It's not just about knowing about God, all right, about him, but it's knowing him through the experiences of your life, of your everyday life. To know God, which really is the point of this new covenant, is to know God. It's experiential. Don't miss this. It's in the everyday moments that God is being known in our lives. It's in the everyday moments. I was trying to think about different moments of maybe my life or people I know of experiencing God. It's in the moment when you're grappling with a suicide in the family and your heart aches with torment, for the torment that that person went through, in despair, and your heart aches for the parents of that child, and you realize that Jesus knows what that despair and desperation is like, and your comfort in some small way. Knowing God is to experience the love of people after your mother and your father have passed on and they weep with you and they share their God stories with you. That's what it is to know God. Knowing God is when you're crying on the couch with your wild children tornadoing around the house and you feel hopeless, worthless, and terribly unappreciated. But you talk to that 78-year-old lady from church, and she tells you, hang in there. It was hard for me too. You can make it. That's what it is to know God, that encouragement. Knowing God is experiencing the love and forgiveness of a spouse after you've totally blown it. And you're drowning in guilt and shame, and you feel totally defeated. And you look at your wife and you see Jesus looking back in pain and sadness, but with love and forgiveness. God is in the everyday moments of our lives. To know God is to know him in our everyday experiences. He is not distant. Jesus is sitting on the throne in heaven, but heaven is much closer than we ever would have thought it would be. And it is. Don't think of heaven out in outer space somewhere. It's right with you. He is involved in the everyday mess of our lives. The struggle we face, though, is a struggle to live in that true reality, in the reality that Jesus is actually present with us each and every day. And with that, I want to talk about this guy. Does anyone know who this guy is by any chance off the top of your head? Probably not. I'm just guessing. This is John Nash. He was a brilliant mathematician. He actually won a Nobel Peace Prize, I think, with another guy. And he contributed to game theory. I don't know math, so these are math things that I don't know about. Game theory, differential geometry, and partial differential equations. John Nash wasn't just a brilliant mathematician. He also lived with paranoid schizophrenia. And just so you know, schizophrenia is usually associated with hearing voices and seeing people that might not exist. That's what we usually think of when we think of schizophrenia. And in 2001, a film came out about him, about his life, called A Beautiful Mind. And some of you may have seen that. And this was actually key for me because in 2001, soon after 2001, I should say, my grandfather had started having dementia symptoms, and he was acting quite out of character from what he normally acted. And it was kind of an interesting time. It was a time where my family learned a lot about mental illness. And I remember watching this film, A Beautiful Mind, about John Nash, and it really helped me to understand just a little bit of what the reality is for those people who are struggling in those ways, who are struggling with different mental conditions in their experiences of life. And I felt like the movie did a wonderful job, in my opinion, at showing that struggle of living with mental illness and the struggle to understand what is reality and what is not, particularly with schizophrenia. And I want you to think about this. Think about how often we struggle with the reality of Jesus in our lives. And this battle we have in our minds a lot of times, or in our hearts, you could say. We're trying to distinguish what's a shadow in this world and what the shadow is pointing us to, a true reality in some sense. And I actually have a clip from the movie I want to show. I have two clips. First one here. And in this clip, hopefully it's not too disturbing, but it's a shouting match. And it's a John Nash is actually, he's having a shouting match in front of other people at school. It's at Princeton. And he's having a shouting match with this guy named Parcher. And Parcher is a person who is a result of his schizophrenia. And so Parcher actually doesn't really exist. But the movie, I love the way the movie has it, because if you pay attention to this clip, you will see that depending on the camera angle, it will show you the different perspectives, where you will see Parcher, the non-existent person, from John Nash's point of view, but then you'll also see everyone else's point of view that's standing around. Like, who's this crazy guy, basically? And I love this because it gives you those points of view. And I want to show you this, too, just to help maybe with compassion. We need to have compassion for one another because many of us struggle with these things, and we don't always realize it. We're not always open about those things. And so from everyone else's point of view, it looks like John is simply arguing with himself. And so hopefully you can see this. Again, this is a shouting match. And Parcher is the guy with the hat on, you'll see. But John Nash, he knows he's not real, but he's still arguing with him. Okay, so we're going to show you that, and hopefully the sound is good.
Is this what you are, soldier? Some useless ghoul? The local madman?
I'm not a soldier.
You're gonna end up in a cell! Old, worthless, discarded!
There's no mission.
And while you rock and drool, the world will burn to ashes!
You are not real! You are not real!
You're still talking to me, soldier!
There's no mission! I'm not a soldier!
John?
Hey, John, it's okay. I just heard what happened. I'm sorry, John.
I'm not a soldier.
John, hey, Nash, hey. Hey, you all right? Nash, hey.
I don't know if you caught that, what John was saying there. Saying, you're not real. And this is the fight we face as Christians. We're trying to figure out what is real and what is not. What is the shadow and what is the shadow connected to? There are times in my life that I am spiritually schizophrenic, maybe living life without God in my perspective or Jesus, the true reality. The truth that he's with me all the time. He's in my mess of life. You know, the truth is we often live in made-up shadow worlds, full of made-up rules to make us feel secure or make us feel like we have something under our control. I'm going to talk about three of those things just real briefly. Two, pretty self-evident, I think, is virtual reality. Two within that would be video games and social media. You know, video games are alternate shadow spaces, and I'm not railing against video games. I think they actually have their value in our society. It brings a lot of people together a lot of times, but video games are alternate shadow spaces in which there are controlled rules and limitations to help us grapple a lot of times with the uncontrolled world around us. It's a way to escape sometimes our limitations in our world as someone who isn't God. We can do things that we can't normally do maybe in life. Or maybe we escape to the shadow land of social media, right? Where we look prettier, you're more brave and bold about politics. And project a shadow of ourselves as we want the world to see. Maybe it's, you know, just me being happy or funny or depressed or pitiful or the hot mess or the one who has all things in order and in control. Or we escape. This one, I think, is probably the most dangerous in some ways. But we escape to the shadow religious world. Just like Israel, where everything is disconnected, where God is disconnected from our actual daily lives. We might have all the right answers, full of good tidings, quick answers of Jesus and God and missionaries in Africa. This alternate reality that we cloak with religious language, high and lofty. We're talking in symbolic rhetoric about, in some ways, it describes the way the true reality of God with us, being near to us. And I don't want to say we can't use these words like glory and omniscience and omnipotence and all of those big, awesome words, words that we sang this morning. But sometimes, if that's what we focus on, God becomes distant to us. It's hard for me to relate to someone who's all powerful. I'll just be honest with that. Or someone who knows everything. But the God who enters in my own life and meets me where I'm at, wow, that is something I can grasp. I had to look this up because I'm not a mathematician like John Nash. There are 168 hours in a week. Yeah. And if you think that God is only present when you're in this building, or that Christianity is only about Sunday church service, I'm sorry, but you are sorely wrong. Last verse in the chapter. In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. This verse is explaining that the old system is truly gone. Or at least, it is spiritually speaking. We still live with it all around us. Have you said goodbye to the shadows of religion? And to your idea of God, a God maybe who's disconnected from you and from and distant, you know, just out there in outer space. Or maybe a God like Santa Claus who lives far away, you never see him, and he just gives good things to you once in a while. Sometimes you have to say goodbye. I have one more clip from the movie with John Nash that I want to show. And you will see three people in this movie, or in this clip. And these three people are, again, a result of his schizophrenia. And again, he knows they're not real. But one is Charles, who he had a good relationship with, good friend of his. Because you make relationships with shadows. You make relationships with the old systems, so to speak, that still crop up in our lives. So one's Charles, one's Marcy, she's like a little girl. And then you'll get a glimpse of that guy with the hat on, Parcher, that he was arguing with earlier. And again, he knows they don't exist, yet he has to say goodbye to them. And they don't simply disappear, all right? He actually lives with it the rest of his life. They're kind of always there, but they're shadows. And again, if you pay attention, you'll see from his point of view, and then you'll see a part where it's like from like reality's point of view, you could say. And I love the way it shows it. He's at Princeton again.
John, you can't ignore me forever.
Charles, you've been a very good friend. I won't talk to you again. I just can't. Same goes with you, baby girl.
Sorry, the sound wasn't that great on that. You get the gist, though. He was saying goodbye. He was saying to Charles, his good friend, he said, Charles, you've been a good friend, but I have to say goodbye, and I can't talk to you anymore. I can't. I just can't. Sometimes we have to say goodbye to the shadows to live in the true reality. And it can be hard to say goodbye to the shadows because, again, we've created these relationships with them in some way. My question this morning is, are you living in the shadows or are you living in the full light of God's new covenant with you as a child of God? I'm going to ask, do you want to know God? If you want to know God, you have to ask him. I'm going to tell you that. You have to submit to him, all right? Say, I want to know you. Will you show me who you are and reveal to me where you have been in my life. I have to say this. There was a couple of youth I was hanging out with. It's a couple of the guys, all right? We were at a picnic or something, and I was joking about if they had girlfriends or not, and I like to pick on them once in a while about that, and they're like, nah. And I was like, well, what about that girl over there? Did you? And they're like, oh, she's probably dating already. And I was like, well, how do you know? Did you ask? You gotta ask in order to know. Do you want to know God? Ask him. Ask him to reveal himself to you. Jesus came to earth. He died for you. He rose from the dead, defeating death. He reigns currently. He reigns as king over all, and he is our high priest. And he has sent the Spirit of God to dwell in your life. And I ask that you would submit to his rule, that you would yield yourself to the Spirit of God, that you would live in the reality of Jesus as your high priest. Don't be spiritually schizophrenic. That's the fight we battle. We battle with that, and it will be an ongoing battle. But continue to keep your focus on Jesus and not just on everything else that you see.